what we're looking at here is that Trump is telling us that he thinks that he is the government, and not just the entire executive branch. He thinks he's the legislative branch, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a walking constitutional crisis. Welcome to Law and Chaos. It's been a week since the election, and Trump is already precipitating his first constitutional crisis. What are the odds that whichever craven hack emerges to take over for Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader will stand up to the Mango Mussolini? Not great, Bob. We got a lot to cover, so let's get after it. Hey guys, I'm Liz Dye, and with me, as always, is Andrew Torres. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing as well as anyone can in today's world.
Man.
How about you?
I'm holding it together, you know, holding it together.
This is my country. This is your country. This is not Twitter. We're not going to abandon it.
All right. So obviously, we've been doing a lot of thinking here about what our role is going to be going forward. That was essentially the subject of our last show, and we wrote about it yesterday in the newsletter. And we will continue to think really hard about how we at the show intend to meet this moment, mm-hmm. which necessarily, I think, requires us to look back at the first Trump administration and the way that we as liberals and, you know, for you and me, Andrew, as members of the media, the way that we treated the Trump presidency for 4 years. I've talked on the show about my own regrets about participating in the lionization of Robert Mueller and James Comey 6 years ago. That was, you know, it was a fairy tale we told ourselves about a white knight lawyer like riding in to save us. And I think that was part of a larger narrative about the power of institutions to hold civil society together in this country. Mm-hmm. Like, I so clearly remember listening to DJ Rothkopf talking to, I guess, like Rosa Brooks and Corey Shockey on a podcast in late 2016. Those are all, you know, public thinkers, smart people. And Rothkopf said he thought Trump would be a normal Republican because he would be restrained by the blob, by which Rothkopf meant that the normal guardrails of D.C. would kind of curb Trump's avowedly anti-democratic impulses. And we'd wind up with someone like George W. Bush, who was like, obviously a dumbass. But at least he understood that there were some rules you couldn't break.
So much you've said there. I mean, first, Rothkopf, yes. You know, glad to see that we've had 9 years of infrastructure week.
Well, but he certainly would admit his own error, yeah.
No, that's a cheap shot. And look, your larger point is a thing with which I agree, right? As lawyers, we are fundamentally committed to the belief that institutions undergird civil society, and, you know, nothing too terrible can happen because this is a nation of laws and precedent. It's as close as I get to a secular religion, you know? And in some sense, we've always known that that's bullshit, right? Like, but Liz, you and I were explicitly taught in law school that the judiciary, you know, at least strives to be apolitical, right? That it's an aspirational goal, and that, you know, looking political is a bad thing for a judge, right? And that's why no one in the Senate, you know, lawyers, pretty much all of them, laughed in John Roberts' face when he said at his confirmation hearing that, you know, the job of the judge is just to call balls and strikes. It's why we're laughing now. But look, you cut to today when Fifth Circuit Judge James Ho, who, and I cannot stress this strongly enough, is himself an immigrant, is now openly angling for a Supreme Court nomination by coming out and saying that birthright citizenship doesn't count for the children of undocumented immigrants. His logic being, and I wish I were making this up, that invading armies can't give birth on the battlefield and demand that those children be treated as citizens, and undocumented immigrants are an invading army, ipso facto, no birthright citizenship for their children. That is, I don't have the words for how filthy and wrong as a matter of law it is. And look, we're going to have to talk about that in depth probably next week. The point is, that's obviously nakedly political behavior by a federal judge, and it is a sign that the institutional norms, the things that give rise to shame that protected us in some fashion for, you know, since the Nixon administration, are gone. Zero. They don't exist. And so, yeah, I think part of the way we meet this moment is by being really honest with ourselves about what's just a norm, what's a law that, you know, is subject to change at any moment, and what's a law that maybe we can count on that's not likely to change.
Yeah, I mean, look, not to perseverate, but I think one of the ways we went wrong in the first Trump administration was to treat him like a fluke, right? Trump won essentially by accident the first time. The polls told everyone his chances of winning were zero, and no one took seriously the possibility that he might actually do it. And so I think a lot of people stayed home, or they voted for Jill Stein or whatever. And plus, he lost the popular vote, right? Mm-hmm. And because we treated him as an aberration, it was easier to not take him seriously, or as Trump's defenders said, to take him seriously but not literally. Or like Rothkopf, to assume that Trump would have his feet mired in the DC swamp and that would stomp him from stomping too hard on American democracy, which wasn't true the first time, and it sure as hell isn't going to be true this time. When Trump says he's going to deport millions of people, and I believe it. He says he's going to use the Justice Department to go after his enemies, and I take him at his word. And incidentally, threats to weaponize the DOJ against your enemies is one of those norms we thought could never be breached, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that the Bill Clinton had a conversation on the tarmac with Loretta Lynch was trotted out for years by the right as like the most inappropriate thing that ever, ever happened. And now Trump is openly bragging that he's going to do just that.
Yeah, and not only that, but the Supreme Court told him he is perfectly entitled to do so, right? That's been contemplated since time immemorial. And a Supreme Court populated by multiple judges who, it must be noted, worked in the Justice Department, right? So they are used to every day they came into work knowing that the firewall between the White House and the DOJ was supposed to be sacrosanct. And that was in the immunity decision. I mean, look, there was a lot to be appalled about in that opinion, but one of the most breathtaking repudiations of the modern belief in an independent prosecutorial authority was right there and signed on to by multiple folks who went through that institution and damn well knew better. So, I guess we're calling it modern, but it's already out of date. I mean, welcome to our new reality, Liz.
Yeah. And look, I promise you guys, we will get to the main show soon. But I have been thinking so much about how we need to prepare for what's coming, as well as how to correct for the mistakes we made the last time. Mm-hmm. And I guess I keep coming back to the ways we failed to treat Trump with appropriate seriousness. And look, look, I wrote for Wonkette. I'm really proud of a lot of the stuff that I did there, and I certainly would not diss the site. Like, those are some of the most generous, talented, honest writers in the world. Mm-hmm. Nothing but respect and love for my coworkers there. But writ large, I think a lot of reporters sort of camped out on social media for 4 years and treated Trump as a spectacle, not as a constitutional crisis and a proto-fascist. Mm-hmm. Like, when it became clear in the beginning, and it was, within a few months, that the courts were not going to hold Trump accountable for blatantly violating the foreign and domestic emoluments clauses with his like hotels and stuff, we started treating him as a joke. And maybe it was a coping mechanism, right? Yeah. Like, that was a really stressful time. It was sort of hilarious the way that Trump's minions would like force military flights to refuel in Glen Ascrack, Scotland, or wherever. Just like, it's funny, but it happened. Like, so he did it so that U.S. service members would be forced to billet at his hotels so he could get the per diem. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, Trump literally tried to have the G7 summit at his Doral Club in Miami. He had Mick Mulvaney, who was chief of staff, go out and announce to reporters that there'd been a search for the best property in the country to hold this, important global summit. And they just couldn't find any place better than Doral. And of course, like, there was no search. Yeah. It was just grift. But casting Trump as a hilarious grifter allowed us to play stupid games on social media, right? To concentrate on all of the leaks coming out and to not treat him seriously. So, look, on our side, there were a lot of clout farmers on social media who kind of pretended that dunking on Trump was actually moving the needle. And that in itself was its own kind of grift, aside from it being a massive waste of time. And I will cop to having participated in that myself plenty. I'm not a hero here. But I think the time for that is over, right? This shit is deathly serious, and we need to stop screwing around and dunking on each other and, you know, dunking on right-wing dinguses and whatever. Like, I mean, there's no way to sugarcoat this. It is time to put aside childish things because bad things are about to happen, and we don't have time to screw around.
I'm with you. Look, I described the impending Trump impeachment with the yodeling jingle from The Price is Right. So plenty of blame to go around. And I think the thesis that you're articulating is looking back and holding ourselves accountable and saying, how can we bring forth the information that will enable us to do things differently this time? So look, none of that is to say that we're going to shift to being all doom and gloom all the time, right? Obviously not. We're constitutionally incapable of not being goofy, right? And kind. Yeah. And the same people we always are, right? It's not that we're not going to laugh, right? That's not your point. Your point is that as progressives, as a movement, we need to draw sharper lines, right? We need to stop coddling the blue anon shit, quit scrolling and liking and hashtagging it. Get to the real business of telling the truth. And speaking of that, let's talk about social media, Liz.
I don't know why you're looking at me like that.
let the record reflect that the witness knows perfectly well why I'm looking at her like that. But okay, aside from your social media habits, Liz, like, seriously, you've written a lot of posts about your reasons for leaving Twitter and not posting there anymore. And then today, tech reporter Kara Swisher said something really interesting over on Threads.
Yeah, just as a side note, I know lots of people dislike Kara Swisher. She's one of the OG tech reporters because she did, for a long time, write admiringly about tech and social media titans before basically turning on them. I think she was always sort of critical, but I will agree that she was kind of a part of this ecosystem. I'm not saying that those criticisms are wholly invalid, but I will say that in the same way that everyone shits on Maggie Haberman, there are plenty of male reporters who have done the same thing as Swisher, and they didn't wind up as public enemy number one of the left. Like, if you hate Maggie Haberman, but not like Mike Schmidt, or if you hate Kara Swisher, but not Kevin Roos at the Times, I mean, maybe sit with that one for a minute. Okay, I digress, though.
No, but an excellent point. But I want to get back to what Swisher said. She says, because some don't seem to read terms of service, at the end of the week, you will only be able to have the ability to settle any dispute you might have with X in a Texas court famously friendly to Elon Musk and not even located in X's headquarters jurisdiction, which is not obsequious to X. Which is why I plan to close my entire account down by Friday. I have over 1.5 million followers there, so cry me a river of that you are giving up. By the way, X can sue you anywhere under the new rules, but by all means, stay on. And so look, we've talked about this, right? But what she's saying is that X Twitter is changing its terms of service to require any participant on its website to litigate against it in the Northern District of Texas, right? Previously, because, you know, they had a sensible contract, they required you to litigate in California, state or federal court. But California and the Ninth Circuit that it sits under are full of real judges who care about pesky shit, like, you know, whether the plaintiff has a cognizable legal claim. And the Northern District of Texas has some of the members of our rogues gallery that you are familiar with from the show, right? Judge Reed O'Connor, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, Judge Brantley Starr, Judge Ada Brown, and they do not give a shit about venue or jurisdiction or the validity of claim. That they are rabid partisans who are going to give ex-Twitter and Musk, as far as I can tell, whatever the hell he wants. And so that's why the company changed its terms of service to require customers to litigate against it there. It's also why the company moved its headquarters from California to Texas. But as Swisher and Reuters point out, Twitter didn't actually move into the Northern District of Texas. It moved to Bastrop, which is in the Western District. But there aren't as many Trump appointees in the Western District of Texas. So Twitter is forcing litigation into the Northern District, where it doesn't even reside, to stack the deck in its own favor, which is like, this is just another data point that we are living in an era where the judiciary is explicitly political, where the promise of balls and strikes isn't even there. And yeah. I guess that's another reason to get the hell off of Twitter.
Wow, tough room. Yeah, okay. I have not tweeted in a year, but you could sort of still find me at the Hal site. This week convinced me it was time to delete all my tweets, which was not easy. Honestly, I tried two different services, but redact and tweet delete, but like neither one of them appeared to be doing anything for a long time. And I have no idea which one of those things actually managed to clear all of my tweets and likes and whatever. It took two full days. Now they're gone. I don't know which one of them. But like, yay tech. I know you guys are all rolling your eyes and like, okay, boomering me right now. And like, fair, okay. But seriously, if you're still on Twitter, get off Twitter. Elon Musk sues everyone all the time. And if we're deciding to quit screwing around and like focus on important stuff, this is one of the things we're going to have to do, particularly since Musk is now using our tweets to train his AI, Grok, that's what it's called. Like, no, as a person who makes a lot of words online, I am already supplying all of those plagiarism bots with millions of words of uncompensated content. So no, they're not going to get my old tweets as well. Like, I'm sure they've already scraped them, but no, I'm not leaving my content there.
Well, and monetizing those, right? And
yeah.
Just to be clear, I know you know this, Liz, but like, I'm obviously teasing. I am seriously very proud of you, right? You had this enormous Aww. Account there on Twitter, and it was such an integral part of being a political journalist in the 2010s.
It was for a long time, yeah.
You made the move to Blue Sky a year ago, so you are way ahead of the curve. That, by the way, is at LizDye, LizDye dot BSKY dot social. Look, and I'm there, and so is the show. You can find us. But really, like, Liz is the one to follow. Go follow her.
I'm not sure about that.
Absolutely. Don't be modest. Look, I am very interested to see what Elon Musk does now that there has been a mass migration off of his site, right? Because, you know, you're right. Like, he's wildly litigious. He threatens to sue all the time and can afford to bankroll absolute garbage suits, you know, ad infinitum. And
in Texas, where they will allow him to sue anyone,
yeah,
because in theory, he has personal jurisdiction over everyone there.
I don't know. I mean, is he going to sue all of us for the mass decamping to Blue Sky? Like, he seems to think it's a crime for advertisers not to give him money, right? He's got two of those lawsuits pending right now. So presumably, it's not a big leap for it to be a crime for us to stop giving him our eyeballs. I mean, why did you steal your tweets from Elon Musk, Liz? Have you no shame?
Yeah. You know, if these guys wanted us to feel shame, they shouldn't have killed it by electing Donald Trump.
Here.
It is Monday. We are going to thank our new subscribers before we get to the show. On Substack, thank you to Griselda, Roger Bond, Braxton K, CT, Loki Maloran, Charlotte, and Ted Lapis.
And over on Patreon, a big thank you to Hot Spear. Welcome back. Chicken Nugget Sauce. Yes, but which one? Danny D, Ryan, Kjetil Jorgensen, Elise Ullery, Z Doctor, Nick Klassen, and Perry Peterson.
Thank you guys so much. Your support is even more important now. And obviously, if you guys want to join their ranks, you know how to do that. Patreon.com/LawAndChaosPod or LawAndChaosPod.com. All right, let's get to the show.
Okay, so you've probably seen Donald Trump is already naming potential appointees for his administration. And it's a parade of horribles, right? Former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin as head of the EPA. Representative Elise Stefanik as UN ambassador. Sure, why not? Apparently, Secretary of State is down to a competition between Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty, Marco Rubio, the laziest man in the Senate, and former acting director of national intelligence, Rick Grenell. And also the fake Ramaswamy. Remember that guy?
Damn it. I cannot believe Donald Trump makes me root for little Marco. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, look, I should stop laughing because these people are monsters. It's just a matter of degree. And look, in some sense, I think Trump knows that he's going to face a lot of pushback with these choices, right?
Sure.
In part because he faced pushback in the first administration against some of his more radical nominees. We're going to get into it, even in the Senate, even from Republicans. At the same time, Mitch McConnell is bowing out as Senate Majority Leader, having thoroughly wrecked the country and led us to this impending disaster. So now there's a fight to replace him among Texas Senator John Cornyn, Florida Senator Rick Scott, and McConnell's deputy, John Thune.
Yeah, just as a side note, Rick Scott has been trying to become majority leader for years. He tried to knock off McConnell last time only to get beaten about the head because McConnell is a much, much better politician. And like, for sheer political and organizational skills, Thune is clearly the best choice. But since the GOP is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump administration, obviously Trump thinks he gets to call the shots in the legislative branch and tell them who should be Senate Majority Leader. Mm-hmm. So here's what he posted on social media this weekend. Any Republican senator seeking the coveted leadership position in the United States Senate must agree to recess appointments in the Senate. I'm not sure where else you'd have them, but okay. Without which, we will not be able to get people confirmed in a timely manner. Sometimes the votes can take 2 years or more. This is what they did 4 years ago, and we cannot let it happen again. We need positions filled immediately. Additionally, no judges should be approved during this period of time because the Democrats are looking to ram through their judges and the Republicans fight over leadership. This is not acceptable. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, hey, remember when Judge Eileen Cannon was confirmed on November 13th, 2020, after Trump lost the election and before Democrats took control of the Senate? Yeah, me too.
I do.
Remember when he rammed through Amy Coney Barrett the week before losing said 2020 election, despite the fact that, you know, Mitch McConnell had held open Scalia's seat for nearly a year so that it could be handed to Neil Gorsuch on the theory that it was illegal to confirm a Supreme Court justice 8 months before an election. It's all pretext. And now Trump demands that Republicans in the Senate stop Democrats from confirming Biden's remaining judicial nominees in the lame duck session, despite the fact that, you know, we still hold the majority. That's the way the law works. But look, let's talk about the larger part of what Donald Trump is saying here, because it's really, really important.
Yeah, let me put on my Trump to English translator hat and see if we can't decipher this gobbledygook. What he's saying is basically, I am going to send you, the Senate, a bunch of absolutely terrifying nominees for principal officer positions in the cabinet and the judiciary. And they're going to be ideological monsters, and lots of them are going to be dangerously unqualified. You may be tempted to vote them down, and even if you don't, you're constitutionally required to hold hearings, and these dipshits are going to suck at answering basic questions, and the answers they do give will be horrifying. So, like, how about instead of that, you just close up shop for a second and let me shoehorn all these ghouls in via recess appointments, okay? And by the way, I'm going to tank the aspirations of any of you guys who want to be Senate Majority Leader if you all don't knuckle under in advance.
Yeah. So let's unpack recess appointments, right? Because this is key to understanding the threat. The advice and consent clause of the Constitution says that the president shall have the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States. So what that means is that presidents can't just unilaterally appoint whomever they want to high offices. Those officers must be confirmed by the Senate under the Constitution. And then the second half of the clause that follows, I've read, contains the further constraints. We've talked about those in the context of, you know, why special counsels are legal and valid. That's not a rabbit trail we need to go down right now.
I mean, we're not going to go down it, but also the irony of Trump escaping accountability for stealing classified documents because of the sacred inviolability of the advice and consent clause, and then immediately turning around and telling the Senate to junk the advice and consent clause is, it's something.
It's something, all right. But here's the significance. The framers of the Constitution thought and wrote into the Constitution that the president did not have unilateral, unfettered power to appoint judges or members of the cabinet or ambassadors or other high-ranking officials. They thought that the president should get first crack at it, but that the Senate was an important check. And Trump is saying, nope, surrender your power to me via the recess appointments clause, which is Article 2, Section 3, Clause 3 of the Constitution. It immediately follows that appointments clause. So remember, Article 2 in general contains the powers of the president. So that clause, Clause 3, says, The president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. So in other words, recess appointments are temporary emergency appointments to keep the lights on and the government running. And this is one of those vanishingly small, happy situations where the plain meaning of the clause, the intent behind the clause, and the unambiguous and uncontradicted evidence in the record that we have from the framers all align. They all point towards a singular meaning, that the president must get Senate approval for high-ranking officials. But that left a practical issue, right? And that's that, you know, back in the era of powdered wigs, and in fact, for most of our nation's history, the Senate was a part-time gig, right? Like, the first Congress ran from 1789 to 1791, but the actual members of both houses sat for only 6 months in 1789 and seven in 1790. That was the founding of the country, and they took 50% of the time off, right? And then there was a lame duck session as well, right? But so the problem is, if high-ranking officials could get appointed only when the Senate was in session, that's basically a coin flip or worse. And they actually started taking more time off in the early 19th century. And look, like, you can't have a functioning government if, I don't know, the Secretary of State dies of dysentery. And the answer is, oh, I'm sorry, there aren't enough horse-drawn carriages to get together a quorum and find his replacement. So check back in 6 months when we reconvene the Senate. So Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Papers number 67, said about explaining exactly what the purpose of the recess appointments clause was. And by the way, what we have in our Constitution is word for word identical to the language that Hamilton drafted and defended, right? So there's no, like, it changed. Here's what Hamilton said. The ordinary power of appointment is confined to the president and Senate jointly and can therefore only be exercised during the session of the Senate. But as it would have been improper to oblige this body to be continually in session for the appointment of officers, and as vacancies might happen in their recess when it might be necessary for the public service to fill without delay, the succeeding clause is evidently intended to authorize the president singly to make temporary appointments during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session.
Right. Okay, so in English, that means that the power of appointment is not a presidential power. It's a joint power with the Senate. And the Senate's express constitutionally mandated job is to reject presidential nominees who are like the product of nepotism or corruption, who are otherwise incompetent. But as Hamilton points out, right, there's this exception to the appointments clause that says if a principal officer dies while the Senate is in recess, the president can appoint a temporary replacement. But if that replacement isn't subsequently confirmed by the Senate through the ordinary advice and consent process, that commission will automatically expire at the end of the next session of Congress. And like, okay, you know, maybe it doesn't matter. Like, maybe the Republican Senate is just going to rubber stamp whatever Trump does anyway. And we will talk about that after we pay some bills.
So before the break, we were talking about whether, in practical terms, advice and consent matters to Donald Trump now that he's going to have a Republican Senate that will do pretty much whatever he asks. And look,
yeah,
the Republican Senate didn't exactly cover itself in glory during Trump's first term, right? But they were not a complete rubber stamp, right? The Senate rejected dozens of high-ranking would-be members of the executive branch, including Chad Wolf, Andrew Putzer, Ronny Jackson, and Ken Cuccinelli.
Oh, Cooch. Cuccinelli was the former AG of Virginia. He famously tried to ban sex toys and anal sex when he was under Bob McDonnell as governor of Virginia. Bob McDonnell, frequent topic on this show. Anyway, Cuccinelli is a loon. He's such a loon that when Trump floated him for the head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the Republicans in the Senate let it be known that his nomination was DOA. So Trump made Cuccinelli acting head of USCIS, and that led to a whole host of legal problems, which we can discuss in a coming episode, since Trump loves to run the government with guys who cannot get confirmed even when Republicans control the Senate. But actually, my favorite episode of non-confirmable Trump nominees involves Texas Representative John Ratcliffe, who's this craven bootlicker who Trump wanted to make his director of national intelligence.
Isn't that the position that Mike Flynn held? I mean, you know, for like 10 days.
It is indeed. It's a cursed position. Anyway, Trump wanted to replace Dan Coats, who was an actual serious person. Mm-hmm. He'd been the senator from Indiana. He'd been ambassador to Germany. He had real national security chops. He was a for real guy. He was Republican. Yeah. He wasn't my flavor, but he was for real. And Ratcliffe, in contrast, was willing to say any goddamn fool thing that Trump wanted him to. Like, Ratcliffe said that actually in 2016, Russia was really working to help get Hillary Clinton elected, which, like, okay. Ratcliffe is an absolute clown. So naturally, Trump loved that guy. So first, he nominated Ratcliffe in 2019. And Ratcliffe was like from the safest of safe seats in Texas. He won by like 50 points. And being from such a red seat, no one had bothered to look at his resume. And I'm not saying he was like George Santos, but he had wildly exaggerated his prosecutorial chops. So it became clear that he was not going to get confirmed. And Ratcliffe withdrew his name. So then Trump said, okay, you guys don't want that guy? I'll put someone even worse in the job. And he made Rick Grenell, the DNI, and for reasons we will be talking about on a future show, Grenell was eligible to be made acting DNI for 4 months because he'd been Senate confirmed for another job. We'll talk about it. I'm pretty sure Grenell was ambassador to Germany. That was his other job. In fact, I know it was ambassador to Germany because he was pretty much a walking diplomatic incident the whole time. Like he encouraged far-right parties to challenge the sitting government, and he threatened Germany to like disengage with Iran or else. I mean, he's like a walking Breitbart comment section, and I guarantee goddamn to you he's going to have a position in the upcoming Trump administration. Anyway, Trump made Grenell acting DNI because he knew that Grenell would freak the Senate out so much that they'd buckle and confirm Ratcliffe, which they did in 2020. Trump renominated Ratcliffe, and the Senate did, in fact, confirm him to get Grenell the hell out of there, mm-hmm. which is a long diversion. But it does show you sort of why Trump is insisting that he should be allowed to just put anyone in there that he likes without having to get them Senate confirmed.
Yeah. And so the Republican Senate, you know, didn't just gatekeep on crazy cabinet appointments, right? When it comes to Trump's judges, they dinged 15 of those as well. And okay, Eileen Cannon made the cut, so, you know, the limbo stick was pretty low to the ground. But, like, here's Republican right. Senator Louisiana's John Kennedy questioning Trump nominee Matthew S. Peterson.
Have any of you not tried a case to verdict in a courtroom? Mr. Pitch, have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Okay. Have you ever taken a deposition?
I was involved in taking depositions when I was associate mm-hmm. at Wiley Ryan when I first came out of law school. But that was...
Have you ever, how many depositions?
I would, I'd be struggling to remember.
Less than 10?
Yes.
Less than 5?
Probably somewhere okay. in that range.
Have you ever tried taken a deposition by yourself?
I believe no.
Okay. Have you ever argued a motion in state court?
I have not.
Have you ever argued a motion in federal court?
No. That is not something that I've had to okay. Contend with.
Do you know what a motion in limine is?
Yes, I haven't. My background is not in litigation as when I was replying to Chairman Grassley. I haven't had to, do a deep dive, and I understand, and I appreciate this line of questioning. I understand.
Just for the record, do you know what a motion in limine is?
I would probably not be able to give you a good definition okay. right here at the table.
Yeah, after that beatdown, Peterson's nomination was withdrawn. He's one of the 15 that I was talking about.
Yeah, I can't believe you made us listen to that foghorn, leghorn son of a bitch. That was Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana. But okay, I just want to make something clear here. It's not just the fear that the Senate won't confirm his candidates that Trump is worried about, because confirmation takes a long time. He's not wrong about that. I mean, part of the reason it took the first Trump administration so long to staff up was that they never thought they'd win and they didn't know what the hell they were doing. Not this time. Now they've got Project 2025 and like this whole, you know, team of horrible people ready to go. But part of the reason that it took a long time the last time around was that the Senate moves really slowly, and it will take a year to confirm all of the people that Trump wants to get in office. And during that time, like, you know, your nominees can get bloodied up pretty good, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you have to put them in front of a nominating committee that's got Democrats on it, a lot of the horrible shit that they've said is going to come out, right? I mean, Jeff Sessions did get confirmed as Attorney General, despite the fact that his own colleagues thought he was too dumb and racist to be a federal judge.
True story. But, you know, considering that that racist little Keebler elf went on to be fired by tweet, and then Trump intervened in the Alabama Senate primary and banished him to the hinterland. So I'm guessing that maybe Jeff Sessions wished he'd stayed in the Senate after all.
Right. I mean, Trump did ensure that he couldn't get his old seat back. But more to the point, Sessions basically never recovered from getting beat about the head by Senator Kamala Harris mm-hmm. during his confirmation hearings. Like, if Trump has to get some of these lunatics through the Senate, Democrats are going to tear them apart on national television. And so what Trump wants is for the Senate majority leader, whoever it will be, to essentially unlock the door and walk away for 10 days so Trump can sneak in half the Star Wars bar and they can stay in office as recess appointments until January 3rd of 2027, which would be, you know, half of Trump's term.
Yeah, open borders, indeed. And yeah. If you're wondering where that 10 days comes from, since it wasn't in the clause that we read, well, it comes from the Supreme Court. So the first time that the Supreme Court was ever called upon to interpret that recess appointments clause was in a 2014 case called NLRB versus Noel Canning. Noel Canning was a distributor of Pepsi, not a person. I don't know. Maybe it's Noel. Everybody I know says Noel Canning, but whatever. Anyway, here's what was going on. As Senator Mitch McConnell promised, Republicans obstructed everything and anything that Barack Obama tried to do in an effort to make him a one-term president. And one of those things was appointing members to the National Labor Relations Board, which is the federal agency tasked with administering federal law governing labor management relations. So they hear, you know, among other things, union grievances pursuant to the National Labor Relations Act.
I mean, they do now, although Elon Musk is trying very hard to demolish the NLRB. But anyway, the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, requires that the 5-member board meet with at least a 3-member quorum in order to exercise its powers. That's 29 USC Section 153. But by 2011, there were 3 vacancies on the board, which meant that it could not meet at all. And so Obama nominated a guy named Terrence Flynn. McConnell obviously filibustered the nomination. He filibustered pretty much everything Obama tried to do. And so Flynn's nomination languished for a year with no end in sight.
Right. So by the end of 2011, President Obama decided that he was going to recess appoint and fill those seats when the Senate went home for the December holidays. But instead of just adjourning for the month, on December 17th, the Senate passed a unanimous resolution which said that they would have these pro forma sessions every 3 days, in which they would technically be in session, but the resolution specified that, quote, no business be transacted on the aforementioned days, right? And one of those sessions was on Friday, December 23rd, and I'm pretty sure that the Capitol wasn't even unlocked that day. I mean, definitely no senators were there, right? And by the way, 2011, if you're asking me why the Democrats, who held control of the Senate, 55-45 at this time, agreed to this rigmarole, I have no idea, other than I think Harry Reid may have been the worst Democratic majority leader of the modern era, but whatever, they did.
Hard disagree on Harry Reid. Wow.
Really? Wow. Topic for another show.
Okay.
But so look, what President Obama did was he took the position that the little pro forma sessions were nonsense, because they were, and he appointed the 3 NLRB members via recess appointment on January 4th. So that was technically in a 3-day recess between January 3rd and January 6th of 2012, when there wasn't even one of those pro forma sessions. But again, right, it's January 3rd. None of them were there anyway. So now with those three recess appointments, the NLRB was fully staffed up and it got to work. And one of the first things that, you know, it took up was a labor dispute between Noel Canning and that distributor's union, where Noel Canning illegally refused to sign and execute the collective bargaining agreement with the union that they had previously agreed to. They took that takesies-backsies stance once they realized that the NLRB only had two members and couldn't meet. So, you know, big surprise. And so, you know, NLRB got back to work, issued an order to Noel Canning and said, sign the damn agreement, get back to work. And instead of doing that, Noel Canning sued the NLRB and they argued that the recess appointments were invalid. And so therefore, that order telling them to sign the collective bargaining agreement was also invalid.
Yeah, that's so funny because that's kind of what happened to Cuccinelli. Right. Cuccinelli as head of USCIS. We've seen this before with Trump. Trump appointed these guys who kind of illegally, and there were lawsuits that said that their orders were ultra virus, totally illegal. It's funny that history rhymes that way.
Yeah. Well, excellent foreshadowing. When a department is illegally constituted, the actions undertaken are void ab initio, right? That means everything that happens is beyond the legitimate authority of that agency. So the Supreme Court agreed with Noel Canning. That was 9-0, right? Although, put a pin in that score for a second, because the four conservative justices in concurrence really penned something that was more like a dissent. I'll get there. But anyway, what the Supreme Court said, what the majority opinion said was, A recess is what the Senate says it is, right? We don't have jurisdiction to second guess them, even if it's a transparently ridiculous pro forma session stunt, right? And then B, and here I'll quote the opinion directly, 3 days is too short a time to bring a recess within the scope of the clause. They said basically it had to be at least 10 days.
Right. Why 10 days?
This is another baffling aspect of this decision, right? So the majority says, look, we don't know. It doesn't say how long a recess has to be in the Constitution. President Truman made a recess appointment during a 3-day Senate recess. Lyndon Johnson made a bunch during an 8-day recess. But then they squared that circle by saying, quote, when considered against 200 years of settled practice, we regard these few scattered examples as anomalies. End of real quote.
Uh-huh.
So they just sort of picked 10 days out of a hat as the presumptive length for a recess to be a real recess.
Right. So what that means is that under current Supreme Court precedent from the Roberts Court just over a decade ago, the court will defer to the Senate's determination of when the body is in recess. And if that recess isn't at least 10 days long, it will not count for the purposes of triggering the clause. Mm. And that means that Majority Leader John Thune or John Cornyn or, God forbid, Rick Scott cannot just declare a 30-minute timeout and like let Trump appoint 100 judges and then reconvene the Senate after lunch. The leader would have to actually close up shop for 2 weeks. And, you know, this could be a lot of political consequences for that. And not for nothing, but like the Senate has a lot of stuff to do when the session starts. I suppose you could wait a month or so and then declare the 10-day recess, but that would basically thwart Trump's fascist plan of getting everything done immediately. You know, I guess he could wait till Christmas or whatever. But leave that aside for a second. What we're looking at here is that Trump is telling us that he thinks that he is the government and not just the entire executive branch. He thinks he's the legislative branch, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a walking constitutional crisis. Anyway, I know that we're functionally in a post-precedent era, but Noel Canning was only like 11 years ago. And as you said, it was unanimous. That means that Thomas Alito, Robert Sotomayor, and Kagan all signed on to it because they were there 11 years ago. Are we at a point of thinking that the three conservatives will be like, oh, actually, you know what? Recess means you gavel out and go take a long lunch break. You know, no need for a whole 10 days. Is that where you think we are?
No. I mean, look, I don't blame anyone who thinks who the hell knows at this point, right? Like, I don't think Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito have any dignity left, right? And I do not know how to fit into my analysis the evidence that has been made manifest that Chief Justice John Roberts personally lobbied his fellow justices in connection with the Trump v. U.S. immunity decision, right? Went around, got them on board and said, let's give this to this guy. But with respect to those three in particular, getting around the Noel Canning decision is going to be a big lift, and it's not one that I think that they're up for, right? Because, look, I want to go back to that four justice concurrence by the court's conservative wing that was a concurrence in the judgment only. It was penned by Antonin Scalia. It was joined by Roberts, Thomas, Alito. And that concurrence said, look, we agree with the majority that obviously Obama can't appoint anybody. But then it excoriated the majority's reasoning in getting there that you just articulated, Liz, right? And particularly the notion that a recess is what the Senate says it is, right? So why don't we marinate in the acerbic wit of Antonin Scalia, may he rest in hell. He says, first, the president's recess appointment power may be exercised only in the recess of the Senate, that is, the intermission between two formal legislative sessions. Second, it may only be used to fill those vacancies that happen during the recess, that is, offices that become vacant during that intermission. Both conditions are clear from the Constitution's text and structure, and both were well understood at the founding. The majority's insistence on deferring to the executive's untenably broad interpretation of the power is in clear conflict with our precedent and forebodes a diminution of this court's role in controversies involving the separation of powers and the structure of government. I concur in the judgment only.
Okay. Let me translate from asshole to English. The Scalia position.
You mean Scalia, not me.
No, not you. The Scalia position, that is the one adopted by Roberts, Alito, and Thomas, is that the recess of the Senate occurs only when one Congress transitions to another, such as the 118th Congress that ends on January 3rd, 2025, when the 119th Congress begins. That's an intersession recess. What he calls an intra-session break doesn't count in Scalia's view and in the view of the three justices who signed on. So that means that under this interpretation of the recess appointments clause, Donald Trump will not even have the opportunity to make recess appointments until December of 2026. And even then, only for offices that go vacant during that recess. So he'll have to like fire everybody by tweet, I guess. And just going back to this opinion one more time, for good measure, Scalia added that he didn't give a damn about whether that would make it harder for the government to do its job. He said that the majority opinion, quote, demonstrates the folly of interpreting constitutional provisions designed to establish a structure of government that would protect liberty on the narrow-minded assumption that their only purpose is to make the government run as efficiently as possible. But convenience and efficiency, we have repeatedly recognized, are not the primary objectives of our constitutional framework.
Right. And look, maybe this is not super clear to non-lawyers, but this decision is part of a larger extended pissing match between the judiciary and the executive branch, right? It began in earnest in 2009, right? Like Barack Obama tried to make the government work, and the Supreme Court felt the exact opposite. And, you know, pissing match is maybe not the right characterization, right? Because for a long time, conservatives, those on the right, complained about what they called activist judges. And what they meant by that were courts that extended civil rights to women and LGBTQ+ people and minorities. They meant abortion. But now the right wing controls the courts, so they've shifted to actually wanting an even more muscular judiciary. Right? You don't hear complaints about activist judges anymore. And look, during the Biden presidency, that's worked out great for them as a short-term strategy, right? Like, as we've seen, Congress was functionally deadlocked. So every time that President Biden took executive action to try and make some good on his campaign promises, be it student loan relief, be it on the minimum wage, be it on non-compete clauses, right? Like, conservatives would then race to the Northern District of Texas and the Fifth Circuit and get nationwide injunctions to stop President Biden from doing anything, right? Look, like we've talked about before and we'll talk again about Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, the end of Chevron deference, right? Conservatives celebrated that because it took power away from the executive branch and gave it to the judiciary. That was the point.
Right. And now we've got a conservative judiciary and a conservative president. I mean, okay, look, he's nominally a conservative. Trump is actually a fascist. And look, what he wants is to arrogate all the power to himself. I mean, this whole discussion is about whether the legislative branch will simply agree to hand its power to Trump because he orders them to do it. And right, the Supreme Court has been appallingly terrible about letting Trump get away with crazy, horrible shit. But I am not sure that they will agree to give up their own power just because he orders them to do it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that these are some of the pending fights that we're going to want to highlight and break down on the show, right? Because there are ways to stop Donald Trump that do not require the court to take a liberal or progressive position. That being said, having expressed some fleeting optimism before we leave this subject, I would be remiss if I did not share a terrifying scenario with you, Liz.
Great.
I don't think even Rick Scott is this feckless, but I've been unpleasantly surprised before. And so here it is. Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution contains a clause that has never, ever been used by any president in history, which means that it's never been interpreted by any court in history. I'm going to read that clause. This is the provision that comes immediately after establishing that the president gives the State of the Union address to both houses of Congress. And then it says, he, the president, may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses, or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. Presidents have convened special sessions of Congress a lot, but there has never been a case of disagreement between the House and the Senate as to the time of the adjournment. So no president has ever adjourned Congress. And look, like, any application of this clause strikes me as self-evidently silly, right? Like, it is very obviously the point of it was to say, oh, if the Senate and the House can't agree as to whether to adjourn for the winter break on Wednesday or Thursday, like, we'll let the president break the tie, right?
Yeah, I'm not. Do they even have to agree, right? I think this is maybe so vestigial. Like, do the Senate and the House have to adjourn at the same time?
Yes, for a formal recess. Both houses of Congress must agree, right?
Okay.
And so if they can't come to that agreement, that's when this tiebreaker scenario kicks in, right? And look, I'm calling it the tiebreaker scenario, but look at what the words say. It says that if the Senate and the House cannot reach agreement, if they have a disagreement on when to adjourn, the president, quote, may adjourn them, right? Unilaterally declare them adjourned, and that such adjournment will last, quote, to such time as he shall think proper, right? And could such time be 4 years from now? There's nothing in the Constitution that says it can't, right? So look, would a Republican Speaker of the House and a Republican Majority Leader really agree to orchestrate, to manufacture a disagreement between themselves as to when to adjourn, only to hand Trump the power to dismiss them, knowing, by the way, that if they did that, that's a one-way bridge, right? They will never have the ability to reclaim it on their own. It will be at Trump's sole discretion at such time as he thinks proper. So Trump could keep Congress in recess literally until the end of his term, right? Like, I don't think that Mike Johnson and Rick Scott or anybody would do anything that self-destructive, but like, I think it'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention this as a terrifying possibility.
I think they would. I mean, I'm sorry. I think they would. In that vein, while the question of whether the Supreme Court justices will let Trump roll over them is currently unresolved, the question of whether the Republican Senate is going to let Trump, you know, steamroll them, that's settled. Because within hours of Trump tweeting out his stupid recess tweet, all three of the candidates were bowing and scraping and promising to take the Senate into recess, you know, at Trump's pleasure. So Rick Scott said, 100% agree. I'll do whatever it takes to get your nominations through as quickly as possible. And Cornyn said, it is unacceptable for Senate Democrats to blockade President Trump's cabinet appointments. If they do, we will stay in session, including weekends, until they relent. Additionally, the Constitution expressly confers the power on the president to make recess appointments. And then Thune said something marginally less obsequious, but functionally the same. Incidentally, Elon Musk, who has apparently been advising Trump on how to president, thinks that Thune is a rhino or whatever.
Right, because, you know, competence is for beta cucks, right?
Yeah, Christ. Look, I'm not hopeful about that. And it is an impending constitutional crisis, and we had to talk about it. But that is going to do it for us today. We will be bringing you more stuff on presidential appointments soon, particularly Trump's practice of using acting officials to evade Senate confirmation and his use of so-called czars, who are functionally cabinet secretaries who have not been confirmed. But we're not going to overwhelm you with too much crazy shit at once. And Look, we know this is a very scary time for everyone, but it is scariest for marginalized groups who are in the crosshairs here. We are committed to getting more subject matter experts on the show to address issues specifically for LGBTQ plus people and for immigrants. And we all need to start thinking about how we plan to mobilize in the coming weeks, because we're all in this together. And, you know, look, I'm glad that you're here with us, but you have to take care of yourself as best you can in preparation for what is going to be a very, very hard time. And, you know, not to get too woo here, but self-care is important. You are important. And you got to do what you got to do. Okay, guys, we will be back on Thursday with written content and on Friday with another show. See ya.
Law and Chaos Podcast is a production of Raise It to Media, LLC, is intended solely as entertainment, does not constitute legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. This show is researched and written by Liz Dye and produced by Bryce Blankenagel. Law and Chaos Pod, copyright 2024, Raise It to Media, LLC, all rights reserved.